Good morning to you all and welcome to Camden BRI. It's a great delight to actually speak as a Camden Day speaker rather than just telling you what's happening on the day. It's a momentous occasion, 100 years, and I'm delighted that John and Sarah are joining us. And in looking back at the history, we've had 9 directors, director generals, chief executives. So I was pleased to be the director general and the chief executive for the last 9 or possibly 10 years. Slightly more worrying was when I looked back in the history of the organisation at 100 years, I suddenly realised I've been here for 33. I've done a third of the total history. And it seems to have occurred really quickly, whereas the first 2/3 look like the olden days. Mine does not seem a third of the 100-year period. But then I guess to many of you and to over half of my staff, when I joined in 86, that probably was, in their opinion, the olden days. We didn't have mobiles, we didn't have computers, we had a very different existence. But the organisation started in 1919 as the Camden Experimental Factory. It was agreed to be established by the Board of Agriculture and Fisheries, and I would say that government bureaucracy was no better back then than perhaps the whole Brexit debate now. The conversation started in 1914. The issue was food security and how do we improve food security during the Great War. By the time they'd agreed what to do, they had bought the original red brick building that we still use, they had refurbished it, the war had finished. But they still continued to go ahead, and it was the Fruit and Vegetable Preservation Research Station. You'll find there's a habit in this organisation having very descriptive names, but they're quite long. And they do get longer over the many years. I have here the first bank book of the organisation from 1922. We were still with Lloyds Bank, so that's another record, I guess. And the deposit account showed a grand total of £750 to start the business. 10 years later, and I'll point out to all the accountants, that took only 5 pages of transactions. Our £750 had become £658, 17 shillings and sixpence. But originally, the organisation decided it needed to have a governance appointment, and so we were part of the University of Bristol. And they were responsible for the organisation with a resident director. In the early 20s, the government agreed that the senior scientist would go on a study tour for France and California, which I imagine was quite an experience in the 20s, going to California. And on that return, the discussion with the government agreed that we should, in the UK, establish a fruit and vegetable canning industry. And that was under the National Food Canning Council, and it was agreed that the research and technical matters would be dealt with by the research station. And that's when the organisation started to move into that area of pretty much looking at all aspects of canning. It didn't seem the most exciting product sometimes. We were real experts on canned peas, and we helped develop the processed pea canning industry, which apparently was a godsend to the new formed industry, because prior to that, they only canned vegetables in season. The dried peas could be canned during the winter period until the next season came round. And I was surprised to find that canned processed peas were the biggest selling vegetable in the 30s. During in 1930, the government then decided that they would try and supplement the funds of the organisation. And so they agreed that they would give an amount of money, provided the industry contributed substantially. And they suggested there was a subscription fee model, which actually has remained in the business to effectively the membership fees today. The government agreed a 5-year grant of £3,000 per year, provided the industry contributed some money. And in the first year, that came to £857. It became £1,500, and effectively that stayed like that for a number of years. We were entirely located in the red brick building that's still on the site. So we had our processing, our laboratories, and all the work we did in there. It was pretty basic. In fact, it was so basic we didn't have any toilets in the building. And if you needed to spend a penny, They put two planks across the brook that ran down the middle of the street, down the middle of the site, and you cross that into the toilet block. I'm pleased to say there was two toilet blocks, one for the bosses and one for the staff. It was only 5 years later we decided to have male and female toilets. And during the war years, this organisation had an important job. The director of the station, a Mr. Hurst at the time, was the canning advisor for all canned foods to the Ministry of Food during the war. And his biggest task was how do we increase production so that we could serve the troops in the war. It was a major activity. But alongside that, he had to deal with the issue, can we can foods but not use tin plate? Because tin plate wasn't important in the war effort. So what other metals could we use? What do we do with canned fruit? We can't afford the sugar. We don't have the sugar to can the fruit and syrup. How will we make canned fruit that people want to eat? How will we develop the quality mark for canned foods, which assure people that the foods are produced containing the right amount of material of the right quality? So again, right from the start, we've been involved in that area. We tried to establish freezing as a technology in the 1930s, and the industry didn't want it. But after the war, it was agreed quick freezing, as it was called, would be something that this organisation would be involved with, and the government moved its £3,000 up to £4,000 to support it. Probably one of our biggest changes came in 1952, and it was a result of government policy. It decided that what they needed to do was to fund industrial research associations, so they created a new structure. And it wasn't just in the food industry. There was a research association for timber, there was one for rubber, one for plastics, one for cars. There was about 25 created at that time, with the government saying, we want to create a different type of support for industry. I find it quite interesting that in the last two elections, the government has rediscovered this model as a whole new model that they're calling catapults and agri-tech centres. So it's again, there's nothing new in the world. I think this goes round in a cycle. But what the government agreed was they would increase the amount of money from 4,000 to 6,000, provided the industry would give £9,000 per annum. Now, it doesn't sound an awful lot, but in that days, it was more than doubling the turnover. And it allowed the industry and the organisation to look at other preservation technologies. And as this happened, we kept changing our name. So the government created us, and we were the Fruit and Vegetable Canning and Quick Freezing Research Association. So it was quite clear what we did. And our colloquial name was the FVCQFRA. And then over the years, we developed what we were doing. So in the early 60s, we started work on dehydration. We started more work on ionizing radiation and became the Fruit and Vegetable Preservation Research Association, FVPRA. And then in 72, we decided we're not just doing fruits and vegetables. So we were the Camden Food Preservation Research Association. And in fact, that's the organization I joined. And then we thought, we're not just about preservation, so we're the Camden Food and Drink Research Association. So we've got lots of names, all quite long, but very descriptive. And as the activities broadened, so did the number of staff, so did the turnover. In 1988, which doesn't seem that long ago to me, or 68, sorry, our turnover was £81,000 for running the business. And in 88, it was 3 million. And staff numbers had gone up by a factor of five. So again, the organisation was growing and becoming more significant to the industry. And then in the mid-90s, my predecessor, Colin Dennis, was appointed not only to run this organisation, but to look at the Flour Milling and Baking Research Association that was based at Chorley Wood, with a view to bringing them into a single business. And that was done very successfully, and so we changed our name again to Camden and Chorley Wood Food Research Association. Caused endless confusion with visitors from abroad. They thought Camden must be Camden Town and Chorley Wood must be Chorley Wood around London, so it won't take very long to get there. And that was, again, another one of our names. In 1998, we acquired our operation in Budapest. It was an organisation that previously worked in the Hungarian industry of the Mira Light Foundation. And I'm delighted that this year we are 21 years they've been part of this business, so it's another celebration for us. And our staff from Budapest, some of them are here today with a display in the back of the marquee. And one of the people here today is Dr. András Sebok. András worked at Mirrorlight Foundation. He was instrumental in the merger, and he has been our general manager as part of this business for 21 years. So he's done a sterling job in keeping our representation, not just in Budapest, but across much of Central Europe and also in the European Union. And post-Brexit, he might still be in the European Union, so we'll not be totally out of it. The last change we had was in 88, the merger with Brewing Research International, which gave us a name, which is our shortest name ever, Camden BRI. So much easier. I do get annoyed when people call it Camden Brie. It sounds like we're an artisan cheesemaker in the Cotswolds. But it, again, increased our ability to work in new areas, particularly in the areas of beer, wine, spirits, cider, and other fermented drinks, and increased our client base for the major brewers that work there. So that's pretty much us up to date. But as you see, we have continued to evolve our services. We're not sitting there and thinking, oh, well, we don't do that anymore. We have done it. So where are we today? And today, our mission is the practical application of technical excellence for the food and drink supply chain. Some important words in there, practical application. We're about solutions. We're about how they're implemented. We're not a university. We don't pretend to be a university. We love working with universities, by the way. But again, we see them, they have a particular and important role in society. It's about technical excellence. The UK has got a fantastic reputation in scientific excellence. We punch well above our weight from our main universities. We just passionately believe that scientific excellence needs to be matched with technical excellence. So the output of science becomes an outcome to the industry and an impact. And the food and drink supply chain, well, until the 1980s, we worked with lots of canners and can manufacturers. We didn't really work with retailers. We didn't really work with the food service sector. But we recognise that unless we're all working together, we're not going to make a real change. It's important that they're part of that. As Alec has said, we have a fantastic membership base. We work with the largest food and drink manufacturing companies. I think 18 of the top 20 food manufacturing companies in the world are members. Those companies are enormous, but they still want to be a member of this organisation and use its services. But we also work for SMEs. As you can guess, the needs are very different between those people. So it's important that we listen to what people are telling us so that our activities are focused on their needs. Some of you will know that every 3 years we undertake a major consultation with the food and drink industry on their needs. The needs need to be scientific or technical, and it's the largest survey of its type in the world. But it's exclusive to the industry. We're not surveying the needs of what other people think they might like. It's asking the industry what it is they need and want. And so to meet all those needs, we now have employed just over 400 staff. The majority are based here at the head office, the Chipping Camden, but then we have staff based at our site in Nutfield in Surrey, in Budapest, and in Leamington Spa in Warwickshire, where we do most of our work on consumer-facing activities. We also, thanks to Martin, have use of an office in South Korea. Again, we can work, and we are working currently with the South Korean funding bodies. Our investment in equipment and facilities has increased. Today, you can tour around some of the areas, but you know, we have a significant investment in that. So what about the future? I hate trying to predict the future. You're on a high into nothing here. I grew up in the 70s. Tomorrow's World with Raymond Baxter was great. All the things we'd be doing. By the year 2000, it was very confident that we'd all be flying to work, either with jetpacks or in cars that changed, and we'd all be eating pills. Neither are close to it. In fact, I think I get more inspiration from the original Star Trek series than from Tomorrow's World. But the food and drink we consume will change. There's no doubt about that. There's a wide range of drivers that will make us do that. But at this point in time, food choice is immense. It's as wide as it's ever been. We have more choice of foods than we've ever had in the past. Do I expect that to diminish? No. There will still be a choice and probably an increasing choice. Do I think the out-of-home sector will continue to grow? Yes. I'm sure we will change how we eat. Do I think issues like food security will change what we eat? Yes. Can I tell you what we'll be eating in 10, 25, 50, 100 years' time? No. I have no idea. Can I tell you how and where people will be eating? No. But I think the issues that we face today are not going to be very different. I think there'll be the same issues for us to think about and to challenge. Issues such as food safety. Food safety will continue to be an issue for us. We are seeing the same problems coming up over and over. But as we continue to source materials from around the world, as we are predicted to consume foods not previously eating, perhaps Sainsbury's jellyfish, as they had in their recent document, we will have to think of what are the issues on safety. Yes, we will develop new techniques to measure things. Yes, we'll develop new techniques to try and prevent things. Our measurements will get faster, more sensitive, more specific, but food safety will not go away. We might want to revisit the precautionary principle that's now applied across many things as we know more about the hazard and the individual. But safety is an issue. Food authenticity will remain an issue. It's not new. Society has tried to find ways to beat the authenticity for many years, going back centuries in terms of substitution of materials. Yes, we'll have better techniques. We'll have more holistic techniques. But I think if we do not consider the ingenuity of man to work around the best systems we've got, then we're going to fool ourselves. Food quality will remain. Unlike tomorrow's world, most of us eat foods to enjoy. To enjoy the food, to enjoy the location, to enjoy the company. But if the food does not live up to the expectation we have, we will not rebuy it. It will not be purchased. Thinking back to the original gluten-free breads. Gluten-free bread was on prescription. It lasted forever. And it tasted like cardboard. Look today at the variety of gluten-free products in our supermarkets. It's phenomenal. Quality sales. Every week I read on something in a trade magazine on a new meat-free burger that's indistinguishable from a real burger. Why are we trying to do that? Because they're trying to get a quality that people can be comfortable with. The issue of nutrition and wellness. That won't go away. We're all pretty familiar with the debates about obesity. I think there's less familiarity in the public about malnutrition, and malnutrition in a developed society. We have sectors of our society that are malnourished. So that will still be an issue, and looking at what we do with micronutrients. I think, in my opinion, one of the most exciting areas is the gut microbiome. I think at the moment we're scratching the surface. We've got the tools to measure it. We're not always sure what it means. But the gut microbiome undoubtedly has an effect on our physical health, but also our mental health. So I think the whole area of food and mental health and wellness will be important. And finally, I think efficiency will be important. For any manufacturing industry, if it's not efficient, it tends not to be as successful. The challenges that they might address will vary. But I think efficiency will still be there. So understanding the complexities of the food chain and how to drive better ways to be efficient will be there. And I am confident that Camden BRI will still have a role in addressing the issues. Yes, we will need to change our services, but we've done that over the last 100 years. And how will we do that? We will do it by listening to you, discussing with our members as to what they're saying they need. We will do it by having a holistic attitude to the food issues. Many organisations work on a single issue, be it food safety or nutrition, but changing one attribute of a food can significantly affect all the other attributes. and we'll do it through our network. We don't sit here in splendid isolation in the Cotswolds. It's about having a network of people. And with our staff, our network's extensive, with the academic sector, with trade associations, with professional bodies, and making sure that we understand what's going on. So as the future, my view is bring it on. Thank you. As Alex said, we'll now pass on to John Carter from Dunoan, and John will again talk about past, present and future from a manufacturer's perspective. Thank you, John.
This is such an honour for me. I have a dual connection to both BRI and Camden. 54 years ago, I was born in a town in Surrey called Red Hill, and I lived in Nutfield. And I lived there for 8 years, vaguely aware at some point of the research up on the hill. And 34 years ago, I came as a student to work here. So I started my career in a place which is, I put here in the speech, rural and idyllic. And I think both sites are somehow quintessentially English. In my mind, and I hope also in yours, ladies and gentlemen, they embody all that is best about British industry, the scientific research and the idea leadership. They combine tradition, historical context. You just have to go to Chipping Camden to see that. At the same time, being at the cutting edge of science and future thought. So I owe my career to Camden. This place gave me a world, not just a window, ladies and gentlemen, it gave me a door. The trajectory of my entire life was created, decided, and influenced by the two formative years I spent here. But isn't it true, I hope for you as well as for me, that when we think about Camden, in addition to the tremendous scientific interest and the professional respect that we accord this place, it's one of affection. Don't we just love it? I love this place. It's because of Camden that I joined the food industry. I left in 1988 to join an American company with a European research center in Munich in Germany. And I haven't actually worked in the UK since. So in my mind, beer is still 48p a pint. In the office I share with Phil Richardson. Where's Phil? Hi, boss. My first ever boss. We have one rotary phone between the four of us. That's a phone where you put your finger in and you move it around. And Stephen Walker, the new guy, has hair. He gave me permission to use that joke. So. That's 30-something years ago, and around us is a sense of change, but also absolutely a sense of continuity. It's not so difficult to picture this place 100 years ago. There will have been someone called Hall on the staff, and I imagine also a strong sense of excitement about the future. If you go back to 1919, it was a seminal year for a number of companies, including my current employer, Danone. A gentleman called Isaac Carasso had moved his family from Salonika, now Thessalonica, that time still in the Ottoman Empire, to Barcelona 7 years earlier as refugees. Also an echo of our times a little bit. He noticed that many children at that time, including his own son, seemed to suffer from intestinal problems. And recalling that health conditions like this were often treated with yogurt in the Balkans, and inspired by the work of Ilya Mechnikov, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1908, he imported cultures from Bulgaria and also the Institut Pasteur in Paris. And since then, it's difficult to imagine perhaps, but yogurt was unknown in Western Europe. So he sold it initially in pharmacies as a medicine. And the company he founded in 1919 was named after his son, who was called Daniel. And his nickname was Danone. So we have a continuity. 100 years later, all three organizations represented here today are leaders in their respective fields. All three have a reputation for the highest quality standards and for scientific rigour, as well as a sharp focus on fulfilling and exceeding consumer expectations. But what will the next 100 years bring? So, the obvious place to start this intellectual exercise is to see what folks from 100 years ago were saying about our world. So I Googled this, as you do in 2019. And surfing through, I found one example from a gentleman called John Elfrith Watkins from the Smithsonian in Washington, writing in the Ladies' Home Journal. I'm not sure if that publication still exists. But then there's a couple of things that he predicted in around our time. He predicted that we would be able to send pictures immediately all over the world. It's difficult to imagine a world without television or the internet, but look at what we can do now. YouTube, Skype. He talked about our industry, because this was about food as well, and he mentioned the ability to send safe food over long distances. Well, I mean, back then, he was actually writing, I think, just before the Wright brothers had taken off for the first time. So now we have international air travel. We have refrigeration. Fridges were invented after he wrote this. And we have long-distance chill distribution, which is an incredible enabler for our business. He envisages a world where meals could be delivered on request to your home. I'm not sure if pizza was invented at that time, but that's possibly the first thing that I thought about. And certainly pizza being delivered is mid-century, I would imagine. I'm not sure if I was doing that in 1985 here in Camden, but since then we have all sorts of apps for delivery, Deliveroo. We have the Amazons and the Ocados. I guess we even have the Royal Mail. Do they still deliver food? And he also foresaw that by 2019, we would have eliminated all pests. Well, that was not a success so far, but we're getting more close to eliminating complete ecosystems, unfortunately. As perhaps that's a story for another event. Let's move on from that one. Well, food manufacturing companies, the last 100 years have been punctuated by both revolution and evolution. And although we often say that consumer trust is at a low ebb, I strongly believe that, in fact, our food is safer than it has ever been. The advent of HACCP in the 1960s, I didn't write out the acronym for HACCP here. Everyone knows what HACCP is, right? Okay, someone's nodding at least. HACCP in the 1960s, a concept was closely linked to mankind's first forays into space. That was the revolution in mindset that enabled globalization of our food supply, and also a step change in consumer safety. So not every development is scientific. Sometimes it's about culture and mindset. It enabled safety in every country, in every company, in every sector of the food industry. If we look at the future, for me, in the midterm, change is being driven by three key trends. The first is linked to analytical capability. 100 years ago, perhaps paralleled by Isaac Caresso and Metchnikoff, the world of applied microbiology was just beginning to blossom. And that's not a technical word for microbiology. It's probably propagate, isn't it? I don't know. There's plenty of microbiologists in the room. But the century has seen amazing developments: the discovery of penicillin and antibiotics, the double helix of DNA, the importance of the human microbiome we're just beginning to discover, the ability to sequence whole genomes. And now we can speculate on what that might mean for us in the food industry in the future. Personalized food for our individual microbiomes, perhaps? Maybe. The second one is about our interconnectedness. If you look at the manufacturing context, in an industrial setting, we call that the Internet of Things, or Industry 4.0. And the last trend is also about interconnectedness, but this time as consumers and human beings. The link between social media, consumer behavior, is just really beginning to have a major impact on entire agricultural value chains. If you bring the three trends together under the umbrella of something what we might call big data, you could say that in the foreseeable future, we will have the ability to know everything. everything about our raw materials, everything about how we make and distribute our food, everything about how billions of human consumers enjoy or complain about the food we make. At Danone, we have around 3 million consumer contacts a year. It's just about possible to manage that with humans. At a certain online retailer, they receive around 3 million contacts a day. It's not possible anymore to do with that with humans. They're using artificial intelligence. And so at least here, the future probably belongs to non-human intelligence. So, ladies and gentlemen, as we sit in this, I wrote here glorious English idyll, but it's quite rainy and cold, so let's just call it England. Celebrating the centenary of one of the most important contributors to food science in the world, we may reflect on that contrast. Our history, our present, and our future is nowhere more beautifully reflected than here in Chipping Campden. And our food has never been safer, and we know more than ever about the science. And yet, as we look out on an ocean of data, contemplating the wonders of our future, we may remember the words of possibly the greatest ever British food scientist, at least when it comes to apples. Isaac Newton said, "If I have seen further than others, it is by standing upon the shoulders of giants." So, Camden BRI, you are giants. Happy birthday. I'd like to hand over to Sarah Bradbury from Tesco. Also, happy birthday to you as well, 100 years.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Sarah Bradbury and I'm from Tesco. I started in Tesco in 2004. And similar to many people at Camden, Tesco seemed to be full of lots of people that had been there for a very long time. I thought that was a little bit strange. So in March this year, when I woke up and realised I'd done 15 years, I realised I was one of those strange people as well. I was absolutely delighted to be asked to come here and talk today at this prestigious event. In January, I came for a week to do a crash food science and safety course, and I have to say, it was absolutely enlightening and fantastic for me to experience so many competent and really expert individuals to help me on my learning journey. So thank you very much. The connection between Tesco and Camden goes back a long time. And in 2006, Terry Leahy came to do the speech on Camden Day. He talked at that point, some of you were probably here, about serving customers. And as a newcomer here today, I understand that change is usually a theme that's discussed on Camden Day. The pace of change within our landscape and the retail landscape today is phenomenal and seems to be accelerating constantly. So I'm going to talk today about our journey over the last 100 years as Tesco. I'd like to talk about it in the way of our story with customers and how we've connected with customers. Because our successful times have been when we've truly listened to customers and understood exactly where they are. To survive and to thrive in this really competitive environment is absolutely based on connecting with customers, constantly learning and changing with them. Collectively, our customers are continuously changing the way they eat, the way they shop, in this always-on and connected environment. Not only are customers changing, but our colleagues are changing as well. The younger communities are caring in a very different way to our aging population, so we're constantly having to learn the way that they're eating and living in today's environment. Retail is changing, the high street's changing, the price competitiveness is changing, and we're all learning as we go, as we move more and more online. So today I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about Tesco's 100 years, Jack Cohen and the start of Tesco. I'm going to talk about the environmental challenges and the changing needs of customers, and the responsibility that we have as a big retailer and as big businesses in today's environment. So the Tesco story started with Jack Cohen. It's a remarkable story of how one man changed the face of British shopping. He grew up in the East End and fought in World War I. But when he came back, he didn't want to be part of the family tailoring business. He took his 30 quid demob money, bought some surplus army food, and got a pitch to sell some. In the first morning, he took £4, £1 of which he kept for himself. Jack was a real grafter and a family man, and he worked hard to give customers what they needed with just that little bit more. It was in a struggling post-war Britain, and he saw all sorts of strange things, from posh jams to pickles to Russian biscuits to American cornflakes. He was a wholesaler, he sold to different barrows all over London, but it was tea that gave him his big break. He did a deal with T.E. Stockwell. He bought a big consignment of tea and he sat putting into small paper bags. And this was a huge success. So he needed to find a name for this. So he took the T.E. Stockwell, so he took the T.E.S. and the CEO from Cohen, and that's where he created Tesco, the brand that you know today. By 1929, he'd opened his first shop, and over the following 10 years, there was another 100 shops that were opened. Britain went to war in 1939, and he decided to fight on the home front this time, fighting for fair rationing and working with the government. Everyone treated equally, everywhere, rich and poor. After the war, he visited America, and he brought back self-service tills. It's fair to say that mid-century shoppers weren't that keen to start with, but within 10 years, it was a revolutionary change. It really took off. Green Shield stamps, or something for nothing as he called it, would become a revolution, a phenomenon across the country. Stores were opened out of town, superstores, and in the late 70s, the next generation of management took over from the then Sir Jack Cohen. The ideas just kept coming. Operation Checkout wrong-footed the competition. Tesco filling stations tore up the rules of forecourts. And many innovations came from listening to thousands and thousands of customers. One in front cut queues, baby changing for mums and dads. By listening really hard to customers is where we created the little helps, every little helps that you hear today. Club Card came and was groundbreaking. It was a recognition and a thank you. Then we had new formats, Metro, Express, innovative businesses that customers related to, from banks to mobiles. So from one market stall on Well Street, Tesco turned into having 95% of the population could get to one within 15 minutes. 6,000 communities globally were served by Tesco. An amazing journey. But with that comes a huge, huge responsibility. And there have been some really big challenges along the way. We've not always lived up to those responsibilities. And earlier this decade, we lost sight of our customer. We lost sight of our core purpose. And by 2014, we were in trouble. We set about rebuilding and reconnecting our values from the boardroom all the way to the checkout. We used our purpose, serving British shoppers a little better every day, to turn back to face customers, shifting from running shops to serving customers. And thanks to the hard work of all our colleagues, Tesco today is a very different business. Our biggest lesson from all of this is around values and purpose and living up to them, and very closely understanding where the customer is. As a large business comes a huge responsibility, and this is only becoming greater. We see over the next 50 years, customers are looking to us more and more to have that responsibility. We continue to learn, watch, and understand as our customers' needs are changing and the environmental needs are changing in their broadest form within which we operate. The environmental and sustainability challenges are changing. We cannot separate them from our customers' needs at this moment in time. They're becoming more and more intertwined. Over the last 20 years, the environmental focus has been primarily on fossil fuels. Over the next decade, the challenges are more and more directly linked to food production and to consumption. It's quite a key day to talk about this with the government making their announcement this morning around zero greenhouse gases by 2050. In order to feed the population by 2050, we need to increase our agricultural output by about 70%. And a third of the food is currently wasted. As has already been referenced, 2 billion people being obese. By 2050, this could be half the adults in the UK being obese. Food-related diseases are on the rise, and we all know the problems that we've had with allergens rising and children having about 7% of children now having allergen issues. This all adds to the responsibility and can be quite a bleak picture for us. Sometimes it feels impossible to balance all of these. But we all have a responsibility to work together. And whilst it's really complex, we're fortunate enough to work with the likes of many of you in this room and Camden itself to work out the solutions for the future. Balancing sustainability, health and affordability has never been more important to us as a business. Working hard with our suppliers to build more sustainable business models and a more sustainable environment is something that we need to focus on. We are doing things already. We work closely with 10 sustainable farming groups. We offer plant-based alternatives to support changing demand of customers. We offer in-store health events, really supporting healthy eating. And we're trying to champion waste within the supply chain to ensure that all food for human consumption is actually eaten. We all need to play our part within this. Whilst it can be depressing, also very exciting, changing times. We've partnered up recently with WWF, aiming to halve our environmental impact of the average shopping basket. No mean feat, and we still don't know how to do it, but the aim is, working in partnership, we can find a way. Whilst we're ensuring we really listen to customers, to take them on the journey and support them as their requirements and demands are constantly changing. They're changing how they're shopping between different platforms. And the rise has already been referenced to the digital interaction over the last 10 years has been absolutely extraordinary. My son Henry is 10 years old. When he was born, the iPad wasn't around. 71% of children in this country now have access to an iPad. Fitbits were launched 10 years ago. And now 20% of the country has a way of measuring their activity. If we look forward to 2050, I don't know what's going to be the solution. Tesco doesn't know where we're going to be. But if I can imagine what might happen to Henry's children if they were 10 years old by 2050, what will they be eating? Their diets will undoubtedly revolve around a little bit less meat. Will we be eating cultured meat or insects? More algae, more compact food. Food will be more personalised. Will it be more functional? Hopefully we'll be using diets for medicine. In what way? We just don't know at this moment in time. So we need to be open to change, listening to customers and trying to understand. How will people be cooking? Will there be an intelligent kitchen with a 3D printer? For most of us, I hope not. But we just don't know. Will there be a robotic arm doing the cooking for us so we can be doing other things? One thing is for sure, that whilst I agree we live in the best food safe environment we have been, the digital role in building trust will grow and grow over the next 10 years. How do we build confidence in our current supply chain? There's so many opportunities. Working together and understanding where customers are is going to be even more important. One thing's for sure, the world that Henry's children live in will be very different to the world we live in today. We're in a fast-moving, digital, transformational world. We need to ensure that the way we produce food and consume food will also protect the planet. We need to listen hard to customers, embrace change, and ensure we really live up to our responsibilities. And it should be a very exciting next 100 years. Thank you very much.